you walk through the garden. Welcome to a special series of podcasts from the Center for Emerging Media. I'm Mark Steiner. On Sunday, March the 9th, HBO will air the series finale of the hit TV drama, The Wire. The show, set in Baltimore, Maryland, is an in-depth look at people who live in urban American centers. The show is focused on port workers, politicians, journalists, drug dealers, drug addicts, and more, and presented these people and their struggles in all their human complexity. The show has become known for its refusal to submit to stereotypes. Even the most murderous characters range from the horrid to the humble to the honorable, some even admirable. Today we're going to talk to an actor who plays one of the more popular characters on the show. For the last several years, Baltimore native Robert Chu has portrayed East Side drug kingpin Proposition Joe. Prop Joe is the elder statesman of the drug game in Baltimore, known for his smooth style and calm demeanor, always quick with an idea or a solution to a thorny problem. His even attitude is contrasted throughout the series with the brash styles of the young drug dealers, like Avon Barksdale and Marlo Stansfield. I sat down with Robert Chu to talk with him about his experiences portraying Prop Joe for the last few years, his thoughts on acting, teaching, and what The Wire has to say to all of us here in America. Did you grow up in Baltimore?
I was born and raised here in Baltimore, Maryland. I moved to New York City when I was trying to do the acting thing. Jersey City, actually, which was 10 minutes away on the subtrain, PATH train, to the World Trade Center for 6 months. Landed one job, and within a week, that job was canceled. The show, there weren't enough funds to produce the show. Moved back to Baltimore, got three jobs waiting tables in hotels and restaurants, and then New York calls. And so I go back, and I got five callbacks, and that's how it all started for me as an actor, and got my equity card and everything.
When was that? How long ago was that?
This was 1991.
Okay.
And after that, I toured with this company called TheaterWorks USA, which is the largest children's theater company in the United States. I toured with them for 6 years, and I started getting a little homesick, tired of traveling with new people every year in a small van and staying in hotels. I mean, the work was good, and the money was good, but as you get older, you want to settle. So I moved back to Baltimore, and I said, okay, I'll just go out occasionally, but they were doing a lot of filming here. And I got a call for Pat Moran. I don't know how, a friend of mine told me about Pat Moran's casting, and I mailed my headshots off. A couple of months go by, and Pat gives me a call to audition for Homicide, Life on the Streets of Baltimore. And I didn't get the part, but what she said to me was, she says, you're very good, you're very raw. When something comes up, I'll give you a call. A year later, she gave me a call, and I got a part in the 7th season opener of Homicide. And that's how it all started with me doing films.
And what was your role in the 7th season?
I played Wilkie Collins, who was a drug dealer, of course, an importer, exporter.
Of course.
Is what he liked to call himself. Well, during that period, you know, those were the roles for young black men.
Right.
But it was a good role. It really was. And it was a three-part episode. James Earl Jones was in it.
Oh, I remember that episode. Yeah. Yes, I do remember this.
And I had wife and kid, and they shot me and my wife. And then the third episode, my little kid was having flashbacks of how his parents got killed.
Right. I do remember that. So now you grew up here. So where did you, the typical Baltimore question, man, it was like, where did you go to high school? Where did you grow up?
Patterson High School. I went to school during the time period where the busing zone laws were in effect. If you lived in a certain neighborhood, you had to go to that school area. Because I wanted to go to Dunbar, which was only 6 blocks down the street from where I lived. But my zone, it cut cross. I had to go to Patterson, so I was bused out to Patterson when they started integrating more high schools in Baltimore, Maryland, which was a great for me because I got to learn a lot about cultures and my comedy awareness grew more. That's my first, my first taste of stereotypical jokes. Uh-huh. I never knew what a Polack was or, you know, Greeks and Italians. I'm like, wow, I'm learning a lot. So it was good for me to go to an integrated high school because that increased my awareness as an actor and as a comedian.
So you said two things I would want to touch on before we jump into the more Wire stuff here. But you said the whole question of integrated schools. And Patterson might have been one of the only schools in town that was really was an interracial school. When I went to City in the 60s, it was interracial. Mm-hmm. And so it was really, And so when I went to Garrison Junior High School back before that, it was in a real mix of people.
Yeah.
But that's missing. And you just talked about how that kind of is a more invigorating kind of atmosphere to be in.
It was great. It really was not. I know some of my closest friends to this day are from Patterson High School. Because learning was fun for me. You know, when you're learning, you don't believe what's on TV all the time or what's in your own neighborhood because you never step outside of it. And when you do, you learn so much more. I think it should be mandatory all over.
Yeah.
You know, you have to learn every culture, every race, every everything. You have to learn it to live in a society where there is that.
And you said you're a comedian. Where do you work?
Well, not so much as a comedian, but I always like to do comedies in the plays. Play the funny guy, the one that would do the fall or the pie in the face, or you know, the villain with the mustache twirl. That was me.
All right. So this is when you worked for TheaterWorks?
I know. This is when I was in high school in Patterson.
In high school.
But I mean, yeah. Afterwards, with TheaterWorks, I was doing plays like Charlotte's Web, where I played Wilbur the Pig. You know, I had my little pink nose on him, pink suit. Freedom Train, the Harriet Tubman story. I played her father. Harold and the Purple Crayon. I was the Porcupine. Just a lot of different stories that we would go out with each year.
So now, how do you surviving as an actor is no easy trick in Baltimore.
No, not at all, because there's not much work. Even in the theater, it's not much. Once again, going back to black actors, there's not a lot of black theater. Every theater in Baltimore usually will have a black show once a year or something like that, you know. But the black theater, the only black theater company that I know of is the Arena Players. But I think they need to do an overhaul on business to where they want to take the theater, because it's set in its ways from the way it was first constructed. And we need to invite new audiences, new people, younger people especially, to get into the theater, because it's just not growing, in my personal opinion, even though I sometimes work there. I'm not working there right now. And this is the nighttime theater. I'm a part of the youth theater program.
Mm-hmm.
That program is always thriving.
So, you know, you're talking about race and theater. It was an interesting series of articles in last Sunday's New York Times. I don't know if you saw it. But it had to do with what's going on Broadway now, where this is big movement towards a debate over non-racial casting. The woman, why am I blocking her name, who plays the detective in one of the TV shows, she plays Lieutenant. She has a strange name. It's not like a name. It doesn't even sound like an American name. What is her name? Anyway, she's...
Which show is it? I'm pretty good with those.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the name of the show. Anyway, it'll all come. But the people are starting to move into these roles that are kind of non-racial casting for traditional plays, not just Shakespearean plays. And there's a whole argument about how that fits into theater.
You know, I'm a traditionalist.
Uh-huh.
Now, here's an example of non-traditional and traditional casting for me. Romeo and Juliet. Was about the Montagues and the Capulets. Now, you could take that play and either do an all-black version or an all-white version, but to have and even mix it, because it's a feud, and there's always feuding among cultures.
Right.
So Romeo could be black and Juliet could be white. But if you take, what is that, the Marlon Brando, a Tennessee Williams play that Marlon Brando was in?
There's
Cat on a High Tin Roof.
That's now I'm an all-black cast on Broadway right now.
That
right?
can work, but to mix it, that would be ludicrous, because it's about family. And during that period, you didn't have a mixed family during that time era. It just wouldn't make sense.
If you did, they wouldn't be in the same house.
Yeah, they wouldn't be in the same house. Exactly. You know,
right.
You know, I'll meet you out in the shed later on. So yeah, that's what I mean by traditional. Some things you just can't mix, because they're not meant to be mixed. They were written at a period when those were the folks and the audience that you were trying to reach, and it was about that set of people. Now, you can do another version of it, but to mix it, have an Asian actress or a black actor and a white actor doing something that was written all for white actors just doesn't work for me.
So now, the role you got on in The Wire, let's talk a bit about that. I mean, it's the prop Joe.
Wow, you know, I don't think... Originally, they had planned to continue him, but I'm so glad that they did, because it was just a two-part gig. I came on as the East Side drug lord with the basketball game and let Omar get the connection to Avon's beeper. And then I set up the parlay with Stringer, and that was supposed to be it. And then the second season, they went to the docks. I said, well, that was a good run for me, but they brought me back to my chagrin. So I'm like, okay, this can go places. And then, unfortunately, luck would have it, I broke my knee. And I had to have major surgery. I have a metal plate in my knee. And I think that was the time they were about to make me a regular cast member. But when that happened, they had to film me behind a desk in every scene in season two. And even, you never see me walking in season two. I'm always sitting down or in a car or something. So I think that stopped my, you know what I want to say.
But you stated, it seemed like in this last two seasons, though, it seemed like you really, your character picked up.
Definitely. But I mean, I wouldn't have been a day player. I would have been one of the regular cast members. I've been a day player throughout the entire run.
What does that mean, a day player, as opposed to a guest player?
Basically money. Your contract. You're in privy to all the press and the travel that the regular cast members get, as you would be a day player, because you're just hired on a need-to-use basis.
But people seem to... So your character, Prop Joe, I mean, it was a... Talk about what you and the writers based that on.
Well, he was, you know, I didn't find out until later on he was actually a real person. He ran a big drug game in East Baltimore. He was a ladies' man for a long time. He dealt in drugs, and he was accidentally killed just being in the wrong place at the wrong time in real life. So, but when I got the character, it's funny, when I auditioned for the part, I'm in the audition room, and all these guys are dressed with suit and ties and clean cut, and I had a sweatsuit on, and I'm sitting there, I'm like, I'm on the right audition, and I got the part. So I think they just wanted to go in another direction with him because realistically, I look nothing like Joe. Joe was, like I said, a debonair ladies' man. He was very small man. I mean, slim, because I saw a picture of him. And they just wanted to take another direction, which I'm so glad they did.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are glad they did. I think a lot of people were really bummed when you. I remember we were watching the episode where your character got offed.
Now you know that is such a surprise to me with all the articles, and I go on the internet. I'm like, wow, Farewell to Joe, we'll miss you. And people are like, oh no, they killed Prom Joe. I'm like, I had no idea, and that really puzzles me. So I'm so glad. I'm honored that they like Joe that much,
because he was a character that. I mean. He was a drug dealer, in the sense of the old days, like the guys who first started dealing heroin on Pennsylvania Avenue back in the 60s. It was a different kind of, a different class of men were kind of dealing drugs back then. It was kind of separate from the community. It didn't go after kids. It was not shooting up the streets. He represented kind of the old style of Baltimore gangster drug dealer.
The word is bond, you know. None of this violent stuff, because that would draw attention. And everything's done just by man's word, you know. And Joe tried to instill that in Marlo and in his nephew, Cheese. But there's just a new breed of people coming up. And Joe failed to realize that. I don't think he failed to realize. I just think he got tired. He said, just let me give it a try. I can do this. He got ahead of himself.
So talk about your prep for that character. I mean, because I'm sitting here across from you now, and you have a very different, obviously, demeanor than your character is. To talk about,
you know, people don't believe that. But as an actor, you know, sometimes you take characters where you normally wouldn't go. Another interviewer said that, well, you're nothing like the character. You don't even sound like him. I know. I'm not him by no means. Preparation. Just, you know what, I think the cast and the writing itself prepared me, because I didn't do any research. The only research I did was speak to Ed Burns, who's a plethora of information. This man just can pull out information at the drop of a dime. And he gave me the whole outline on this man and how he is. And so all the nuances, like the voice, I just started implementing. I felt that he would talk in a low key, you know. Just sort of not the Marlon Brando-ish, they tell me my son Michael. Not that far. But he just would keep it low, too, you know. Smooth talker, you listen to somebody with a low voice. When somebody yells, you usually tune them out. So I said, that'll be Joe, and he'll be laid back.
Because he had a sense of power. He was there. It wasn't just your physical weight.
Right.
But that added to it. It was also the character was just grounded. He was like there.
He didn't react, you know, and jump when something bad was going on. He always wanted things calm so he could think. And fast with the with an idea. Right. You really have to watch, though, because he'd come up with something really fast and you wouldn't even know it.
So you miss Prop Joe?
Yeah, I do. I do. Especially the final season because the writing really kicked. I mean, I love the stuff they were doing in the fifth season. I really do. And just working with the kids privy to that in the fourth season, that was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun. So we were moving.
What do you think about the You were there opening night, weren't you, at the premiere at the Senator Theater?
Yes, Senator Theater.
And there was a demonstration outside. Some folks in the black community who were very upset about the portrayal and people being in it. What did you think about that?
That was surprising to me. And I tend to forget. I'm like, well, everybody has different opinions. But when we came out of the theater, I stood there. I'm like, are these people insane? What do they mean we're portrayed inappropriately and stereotyped? I'm like, it's the total opposite. Those are real people. You see this in the streets every day. And the people who were picketing look like they saw this in the streets every day, if I can get right to the front of it. They look like somebody said, hey, you want $50? Come protest outside this theater. I mean, it was just, I think it was put on by somebody who just had a gripe against the show, propped up by one individual. Because the bulk of the city loves that show, black, white, anybody. It's just a great show. I think politically it might rub some noses the wrong way because they're telling the truth about a lot of things. But it's just a very realistic, inspiring point of truth. And it's only a small portion of Baltimore that's like this. I mean, we have parts of Baltimore that are wonderful. Beautiful neighborhoods, the Inner Harbor is growing. The downtown area is being refurbished. Hopkins rebuilding everything. I mean, Baltimore is a growing major city. And there are just some pockets that are really poor and drug infested. And The Wire just portrayed that.
So what do you feel about what The Wire was just also, you said politically about what The Wire was trying to say about where America is? We talked a lot about to David and to Ed and Clark Peters and others about just the kind of philosophy behind The Wire, and how have you watched the show? Do you watch the show as well?
I only watch the show after the run has gone on the television, and then I sit and watch the whole thing at one seating.
Uh-huh.
So I haven't seen any of the fifth season episodes.
You haven't seen any of the fifth
except for the first one. Uh-huh. I went to the premiere.
Could be on the premiere. Right, yeah.
I haven't even seen my death yet, so I don't know how that turns out. I haven't seen anything.
So now why do you do that?
Because I like to do it all at one sitting, back to back to back. I don't like to wait for the next episode.
Mm-hmm.
I like to view it as a long mini series.
Do you feel that it is as much of an epic as some people are making it out to be? That it is kind of this kind of look at the state of urban America at the turn of the 21st century that'll be looked at for a long time to come as kind of a piece kind of to study what our world was like at this point?
Yeah, I do. And I think the difference is because we've seen different movies that portray, you know, downtrodden people on drugs and welfare and all this kind of stuff. But I think with David and Ed is that it's there's no falsehoods in it. It's all pure truth. You have some of the greatest actors on the show, definitely the best writing. And the way it's filmed is so realistic. That it touches people in a different manner. It's not the Hollywood-sized version that you say, oh, those are the bad people. We always see that. When you look at The Wire, it's all done from a fresh point of view, like, I never knew this, but you watch it all the time, but it's always been Hollywood-nized, if that's a word mm-hmm. I can use. But with this, it's like right in your face.
Yeah, I love the way they set up your characters in his little shop.
I love that. You know, here's this man that's a drug lord with all this money coming in on a daily basis, and he's fixing old clocks and watches and VCRs. Wears the simplest of clothes, you know, a big Hawaiian shirt, a pair of nice slacks, and some tennis shoes, and he's good. Only a watch. No ring, no bling, none of that. That's Joe.
That was the old days.
That was the old ways, yeah.
So what do you do now? I mean, the Wire's gone.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, with the writer's strikes just being over 2 weeks ago, you know, it's the season now where everything would have been done and filmed. So filming an audition season and really doesn't start until like September sometimes. But there's still a lot of movies that are being made right now. So I've auditioned for about 4 movies so far.
Locally or outside of Baltimore?
Outside of Baltimore. 2 in New York and 1 via the internet for California, because you can film yourself. They'll send you the size email. You read the script, you film yourself, and send them a version. You can, instead of them flying you over back and forth.
So what kind of roles are you getting to audition for?
Well, funny enough, the first one I got for was for a serial killer. And I'm like, what a stretch. But he was working in cahoots with a doctor who was the one actually killing the women. I was raping them and bringing them to him, and then he would cut them up. I thought that was a great... I thought it was great. You know, two villains for the price of one. The next one was just a landlord in a it was an alternate world where everything, you couldn't tell a lie. Whatever was on your mind, you had to speak. And I'm evicting this guy, and he's like, but I don't have the rent. I know, that's why I'm here. You know, you just say what's on your mind. Another one was for a bouncer in a voodoo shop, a psychic voodoo lady that tells your future. I was the bouncer, Pookie. And the other one, I don't even remember, because I think it was the very first one.
So, now, are you still teaching?
Not right now. The Arena Players Youth Theater, well, the whole building is under reconstruction. And what happened was they had got a $100,000 grant from the city or state, but to our chagrin, it's a matching grant. They have to match the same amount before anything's implemented. So unfortunately, half the staff was laid off until they do the reconstruction for the heating and air conditioning system. And we didn't have a large enrollment this season. So it's downsized, pretty small. So not until the end of March or June will I be going back with my kids.
So now, I have a lot of friends who are actors who live in this town, and I know how tough it is to live as an actor. So how does one survive?
Out of town, it's almost impossible. You just have to get another job. Waiting tables, a clerk here and there, you know, the mail, post office, secretary work, computer. You have to get a 9-to-5. That's the only way.
And that's how is how you survive when you're not working?
And actually, well, ever since I became an actor, whenever I would work or tour, I'd save money. So I'd live off of the money I'd saved and while I'm looking for something else. I've never been one, ever since I was a kid, I'm always going to have money. So even when The Wire was over, I had saved up all my earnings from the previous year. And keep going with that until the next thing comes along.
That's great. That's great. Well, your character was—I think you said you were shocked, but you created almost in your own way a cult figure in this improv show.
Which still is shocking to me, believe it or not. Very much so. I heard Chris Rock just did stand-up here in Baltimore, the Lyric, and his opening. Monologue was, they killed Proposition Joe. Why the fuck they go and kill Proposition Joe? How come they ain't kill Marla? I'm like, are you serious? They say, yeah. Half of my friends were telling me this. I'm like, man, Chris Rock is talking about Prop Joe.
Well, see, that's something to feel good about. You created a character that said a lot to a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm really proud of that. I'm proud of the whole organization, the Wire family, you know, from the writers on down to the craft table people. It was nothing but fun and a privilege to work on that set.
So do you have a scene or part of your character that has meant more to you than others that stays with you?
You know, I don't know. Every moment with Prop was always a privilege for me. One that stands out was when Marlo came in the shop with the clock, and he puts the gun to my face, and we didn't even rehearse it. We just said, okay. Well, the first take was just like the first. They did one rehearsal, and they said, okay, let's film it. It was just automatic. It was like I'm living this right now with, you know, a gun being pointed in my face, because that's happened to me in real life twice when I was a much younger man. So that stays with me, because that was I drew upon that, you know, a gun being pointed to my head, and it was like, okay, I'm just going to be calm. I'm not going to look. I'm not thinking about death. And that's the thing that stays with me with Omar. I said Marlo. I meant to say Omar.
Omar, right. He was an interesting character.
Very much so. A great guy to work with, too.
Was he?
He was actually the first person I met on the set. Because my very first day of filming, I was doing the basketball scene with Avon and Stringer. And the next scene was with Omar in the shop trying to get the number, Weebay's phone number.
So we were talking about a bunch of things a minute ago, but one of the things you were commenting on was the fact that there were no Emmys, which always shocked so many of us who...
Yeah, why we didn't receive, and not so much as winning Emmys, but Emmy nominations.
Yeah, right.
You know, with critically acclaimed writers, and even critically acclaimed writers who said that The Wire was like the best television show there is, and especially the fourth season with the whole thing about the kids. And, you know, I was the drama coach with the four young men on the show.
You were the drama coach. So where did that come from? How'd that happen?
Because I worked with the Arena Players Youth Theater Program, mm-hmm. and Pat Moran called me one summer and says, hey, we're doing the school system for the fourth season of The Wire, and I understand you have some kids. I need you to send me to some kids now. So I prepared. She sent me some sides, and I prepared about eight of my boys, because the sides were all boys, and sent them to her. And when they came back, she called me. She says, Robert, I don't know what it is, but I think every last one of those boys was good. She says, what are you doing with those kids down there? I said, this is our program. She says, every one of them, they were so well prepared as actors, and all of them were good. We wound up with two of them having major roles. Well, the four guys were not from my youth theater program, but the young man who plays Sherrod, Bubbles' sidekick, the junkie.
Yes.
He's from the youth theater program. The girl in the first episode of The School System that cut the girl in the face, Razor Girl, Charmaine, she's one of my students. And then you had Rakaya, who was always in the classroom scene, so she gets up and yells at somebody, and she busts through the door. She's one of our students. And about 22 other students of mine had parts on there, especially Justin Burley and Melvin Russell. They were part of Marlowe's crew. The one came up to the car where Burrell was in it. He says, you want the five? And he puts his police hat on, and the kid still doesn't realize it's a cop. And then he backs away from the car as Justin. And Melvin was Marlo's sidekick. Actually, Melvin was the first one we sent down because they were trying to cast a part of Marlo. And they loved Melvin, but he was just too young. So they said, well, we'll keep him on because he's so good. So 22 of my kids got little small parts here and there on the show.
That's amazing. So is that your real passion, teaching acting?
That's my second real passion.
Your first is acting.
Yeah, when I'm not working, I'll teach. You know, I love to inspire young people and bring out what they already have. I never like to put what I do on them. I always bring out what they have. So let me see what you have. And I'll ask them questions to make them think about what they're doing instead of showing them. Because when you show someone something, they'll do it the way you do it. And which is the way you should teach people, but not in theater, I don't think. I think you should allow the actor to become unique.
So what did you study acting?
I didn't study. You know, during my period where with the black and white TVs, you know, you had all these great fantasy shows like I Dream of Jeannie, Bewitched, Gilligan's Island, Star Trek. You know, I always wanted to be on Captain Kirk's team, you know, with the phaser and exploring new worlds. And so I emulated a lot of those B television shows. And so I was a little ham, you know, in high school as an actor. And I remember the day I learned to act. I was standing in my doorway at my mom's home. I was 14, and one of my nephews had passed away, and we just came from the funeral. And I'm standing there in the doorway, and I'm just crying. And I'm like, oh, this is how you act. Because I was really a bad actor as a kid. I was such a ham. And the tears were so real. And I'm like, oh, this is how it should be when I'm acting. And I just retained that moment thinking about him just passing. And whenever I started to act, I have to do real stuff like it really happens. And that's training. Who needs training now? And I know what it means to act. That's how it all came to me. If that's strange that those were my acting teachers.
Life.
Exactly.
That's great. So may I ask you a personal question?
Sure.
How old are you?
You know, I read an article where they said Prop Joe is guessed to be about 55-ish or so. I'm like, oh, my God, they took me up about 15 years.
I didn't think you were that old. No.
You know, actors hate to give their age because then people are here and say, well, we can't cast him because he's...
I'm good friends with a couple guys in the cast. One of my best friends is Bob Wisdom,
mm-hmm.
plays...
Okay, yeah, Colonel Burrell.
Yeah, and he's an old friend. We acted together at Studio Theater. We've been friends ever since. And if you look on his website, it says that born 19 ?
I'll just say I'm in my younger 40s. That's where I am, which is not bad. If I lose the weight, I can still look 30-something.
Well, no, but your character, Prop Joe.
Yeah, I think Prop Joe was about 50-something.
Yeah, his character seemed older. Yeah,
most definitely.
He wasn't, you know, he seemed like a much wiser and settled man. He was not the same as...
Definitely, and that's where I portrayed him at, so maybe that's why people think I'm that age.
But yeah.
Yeah, full of wisdom, old Prop.
So what are the kids doing now that you were teaching that were in The Wire?
Well, the four young adult stars, Halito and Tristan and Jermaine and Maestro, they're busy as all outdoors. I mean, they've been appearing on Cold Case, Law & Order, Aquila and the Bee. Halito was in that movie. Jermaine has been opening for a lot of hip-hop and R&B artists and speaking at a lot of occasions. They're filming all over the place. They have a lot of work coming up.
That's good, man. They're from D.C. or from here? Where are they from?
Well, two of them were from New York. One was from Boston, and one's from right here from Maryland. Jermaine, the one that played Dookie, the homeless boy, he's from here. He's from Maryland. But Maestro, that played Randy, he's from Chicago. And Tristan and Halito, who played Michael and Michael and can't think of his character name. They're both from New York, Brooklyn, and Staten Island.
Did you stay in touch with them?
No, the last I heard from them was at the reunion after the premiere. No, I don't stay in touch with any of them. They're too busy. We have email address, but we don't usually commute unless they have something coming up and they'll email me and say, I'm in this, I'm in that. And that's the same with the other actors. We don't stay in touch because everybody's so busy.
Right.
I stay in contact with a couple of people. One of the actors is Fat Face Rick. He had a small reoccurring role on the show because we do a lot of auditions together because we're in the same typing cast, you know, big men, elderly men. So we go out for basically the same parts. And Snoop, Felicia, she lives in my neighborhood, but she's busy, too. She's promoting her book.
Her book, yeah. I interviewed her for a book. Yeah.
Anwan, who's in D.C., I think he's extremely busy, too. I think he's making a movie in Pennsylvania right now with Angie Stone. So they're keeping pretty busy. Me, I'm getting in there, but, you know, like I said, with the writer's strike being over, I'm just auditioning a lot.
That's great. Robert, this has been great. I appreciate you taking this time with us and coming in today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Look forward to seeing what you do next.
Me too. But you might not recognize me because I won't have the Prop Joe voice. That was just a voice. Sorry, folks.
But it was a good one.
Thank you.
You're listening to a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy. We're assisted by our engineer, Devin Murphy, and we want to thank Clean Cuts Music and Sound for studio space. And you can visit us on the web at marksteinerblog.wordpress.com or just Google Mark Steiner Blog. And I'm Mark Steiner for the Center for Emerging Media. Take care.